I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. It was passion that drove my guest, Connecticut chef and author Michelle Nichon, to work on getting healthy foods to low-income people. How would he do this? By doubling the value of food stamps at farmers markets. When they're used to purchase fruits and vegetables, those fruits and vegetables can be expensive for families living on food stamp budgets. It's a revolutionary idea, and it is working, thanks to Nichon's work and his nonprofit organization, Wholesome Wave, funded in part by Newman's own foundation. The late Paul Newman co-founded the Dressing Room Restaurant with Michelle Nichon to offer good food at the Westport Country Playhouse. Michelle Nichon, welcome back, my friend.
Thank you, Faith. Good to be here. Always good to be here.
Me too. So you have this vision of lower-income citizens being able to double the value of food stamps at these farmers markets, you know, buying fruits and vegetables. But I want to know what it was like for you the first time you witnessed that transaction.
Oh, it was amazing, because we designed the program in a way that there were no strings attached. You know, I'd seen a variety of different approaches over time in trying to crack the conundrum of how do you get low-income families to choose better food and feed their families healthier, because of all the health disparities, the ones that cost us the most are most suffered in communities of poverty. And just they weren't resonating, and it was always about studying this. And so what we did was we just basically ran this 2-for-1 fruit and vegetable sale. And when there were no strings attached, the joy with which these citizens participated in the program was astonishing. They're like, first it was kind of like suspicion, like, what's the catch? Like, no, you just swipe your card for $10 and we'll give you 20, or swipe it for 20 and we'll give you 40, and then go and buy your fruits and vegetables. They're like, okay. Well, and it's amazing to watch.
Well, do you remember the studies where the presumption that low-income people weren't interested in fruits and vegetables in general, just on principle, there is no interest. That nobody had considered that these were among the most expensive foods. Mm. And if you were trying to stretch for 2, 4, 6, 8 kids, you can't afford to use your food stamps for fruits and vegetables. You've got to spend it on these other dry goods.
Well, we've become a nation that is exceptionally adept at just assuming things. You know, so when you look at what happened in Shifting Sands communities that once used to be middle class, upper middle class, even affluent, that are now in poverty. I mean, you know, the Bronx used to be a thriving middle class community, and now it's not. And people go into communities of poverty and see that grocery stores aren't there, and they assume that they're not there because people in poverty don't care about things like fresh fruits and vegetables. The fact is that those grocery stores were there once they left, because those communities can only afford to shop the center aisle of the grocery store. Most of us, thankfully for us, if we're middle class, upper middle class, affluent, we can go to a grocery store. We can just buy whatever we want. We don't look at and we really don't effectively compare the price of fruits and vegetables against other things. We just buy what we want. It's not a decision point that we have to make. We just either do it or don't do it. It has very little to do with price. Where we shop, you know, some of us will go to Costco because we can't believe we saved $30 on a bag of groceries or something. But in these communities, often, if you take food stamps out of the equation, a family of four has $2 to spend on dinner. A head of broccoli is $2. A six-pack of instant noodles is $1.39. So are you going to put in front of each family member a quarter head of broccoli? Or are you going to take 6 cups of instant noodles, make 4 bowls of noodles, and then have a couple of Twinkies or a couple of bags of cheese thingies, so when the kids are kind of whimpering that they're hungry before they go to bed, they have something to eat? That's what's happening in these communities. It's not people sitting back on a couch watching TV, laughing as they cram a bunch of snack food in their mouth and drink, you know, 2 liter bottles of sugared soda. But that's the assumption that we've made. So
you and I spent last night doing the same thing.
Yes.
We were watching you as part of a documentary. This is an original documentary that CPTV has done. It's called Give It All Away. Mm-hmm. Newman's Own Recipe for Success traces Paul Newman's legacy of giving. We'll tell you about when that's going to air in just a couple of minutes. It's going to air multiple times, but it's premiering on Tuesday, December 17th at 8 o'clock. And you were one of the groups looked at in this documentary, and both of us said that we were choked up watching it. And I didn't realize, we've known each other quite a long time, but I didn't realize that you came from a kind of poor circumstances.
Absolutely. I mean, none of us, my sister eventually worked her way through college, but my thinking of college was out of the question for my family. And even the thought of taking on a student loan was absolutely out of the question. My older brother and I moved out of the house early because my parents fell on even harder times and had to downsize so that they could get my younger brother and younger sister through school with a roof over their head. And so we struggled with that on and off throughout my dad's long career as a tool salesman, and you know, my mom, you know, working as a waitress in restaurants and things like that. But the one thing that was interesting for us in our lens of poverty was different because she was a farmer. My dad was a farmer. She dug up our back inside yard and planted a garden. We canned, we pickled. We used to go down and work what was left of my grandfather's farm in the summer times and bring back vegetables and things and canned and pickled stuff from there. So good food was never really a problem because we had that level of self-reliance where my mom saw the wisdom. It costs $1.29 to buy a packet of tomato seeds. And out of a packet of tomato seeds, if you plant, you know, if you have 15 to 20 successful plants, you've got over 100 pounds of tomatoes for $1.29 and some sweat equity. Where if you go to a grocery store to buy even the cheapest tomatoes are about $1 a pound, right? At the very least. So when you spend your money on seeds instead of finished food and you have a little bit of expertise, you can actually go a long way.
So easy to see the link for you.
Absolutely.
Your passion for having people from low-income neighborhoods have access to the kinds of foods that will keep them healthy and strong. What was interesting to me in the CPTV documentary that we got a chance to see is, you know, this idea that you could make something of your life, explain your passion to Paul Newman. And he turns to you and says, "What are you waiting for?"
That was pretty cool.
You've got to start a nonprofit. Go ahead and do it.
Yeah. Well, you know, coming from Paul, having gotten to know him pretty well by the time he plugged me with that question was huge for me because it's something that I had thought about doing. I had been working with my partner, Gus Schumacher, doing hobby nonprofit work with immigrant farming communities, hooking them into heirloom American farming communities, aggregating that, getting it into restaurants at premium prices, working in underserved communities to take that same immigrant refugee produce and get it into a farmer's market in Lowell, Massachusetts, where there are Hmong citizens, but no access to land, and seeing that people living in poverty valued and absolutely wanted better food, but the affordability factor was the thing that was the killer. And I kept telling myself I needed to do something about it someday. And when Paul was asking me about what some of my hopes were, I told him, I said, if what we're doing now could ever translate into something where everybody could at least afford to put the same tomato on the table, that would make me a happy man. And that's what he said. What are you waiting for? That's the America you and I grew up loving. That's the dream that we feel that everybody should have access to. Get off your ass and go out and do it is basically how he put it to me in very, very, very direct terms with a smile on his face.
Yeah. So you were making a deal at that point to open this restaurant, found the dressing room in Westport, mm-hmm. Connecticut together. Of course, that restaurant continues, and so does Newman's Own Foundation. All of the profits from the sale of all those Newman's Own products going back into charitable giving. Amazing. This is Michelle Nichon, chef and co-founder of The Dressing Room in Westport. He is a cookbook author, founder of Wholesome Wave. That's a Connecticut-based nonprofit that creates programs to make food more accessible to low-income populations. Nichon's Wholesome Wave project is one of several funded by Newman's Own Foundation. And this is what happens to the profits from Newman's Own products that are sold in stores. And you can see a CPTV documentary about the Newman's legacy in Connecticut, describing Michelle Nichon's project, the Fidelco guide dogs for returning soldiers, the Serious Fun camps for sick children, and the Wesleyan University Kenya project focused on one of Kenya's poorest places. And that CPTV original documentary, Give It All Away, premieres Tuesday, December 17th at 8 p.m. And for information on all the other airing dates, you can go to our website now, WNPR.org. Click on Programs for the Faith Middleton Show. It is a very moving documentary. So, Michelle Nichon, where does our food stamp law stand right now? What's the bill look like? What's going on?
The bill looks like a three-ring circus. I mean, it's like almost everything that's happening these days in our nation's capital. There's this incredible inaction. It's interesting because our legislators seem to have a really good reason for why they are not voting on things or what it would take for them to vote on something. And none of it really truly makes any sense. And unfortunately, the food stamp program that it's really called SNAP. It's the Supplemental mm-hmm. Nutrition Assistance Program. And it's the largest part of our farm bill. So the farm bill that really helps determine the market structure, what's happening in all of agriculture from really big agriculture to small agriculture and everything in between is in that farm bill. But the largest part of that budget is that Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program or the food stamp program at $80 billion a year. And it's at $80 billion a year right now because we have 50 million Americans living in poverty, real poverty, and 50% of those being children, and another large percent being seniors, and then another large percent, over a million veterans, rely on that food stamp program. And there is a segment of our political society that continues to paint people struggling in poverty as some kind of group of lazy people that are laughing as they take money from other Americans and sit on the couch, as I was describing earlier, which just isn't – it's not what's happening. If 1% of everybody living on SNAP is actually acting that way, I would be surprised. So it's sitting in limbo. A bill has twice passed the Senate with a very – bipartisan, very bipartisan, I think, 67 to 23 at one time.
The House is another story.
Well, the House Ag Committee twice passed a similar bill with some deeper cuts to SNAP, but not irreconcilable if the bill ever would have got voted on and then could have gone to conference. But twice under two different chairmen passed even a wider majority vote saying yes, only to fail on the floor because mm-hmm. there's this small radical group of folks, mostly affluent, never saw likely a day of poverty in their life, let alone ever shook the hand of somebody living in poverty or looked them in the eyes and asked them how they might be able to help them get out of their plight, just making decisions that this isn't something that we should be funding. So one of the things that I would like to encourage people who aren't certain how they feel about the food stamp program and is it really good or not for America would be, like, for instance, in Westport, plenty of affluent people there. You're a 12-minute drive from Bridgeport where there are families of four trying to make it on $12,000 a year. Go to their dilapidated coffee table, if they have one, in their home without a working stove. Sit down and start to really engage with them in a way that you really learn what their life is like, why they're unemployed, why they apply for multiple jobs and never get connected with a job or any meaningful employment, why they're having a tough time with education. Until somebody actually does that, please do that and then tell me how you feel about poverty in America. Do that and then tell me how you feel about the food stamp program. But don't sit in a nice, comfortable couch, drive a car, have the right to be able to order anything you want from any menu in a restaurant, and then call somebody in poverty a lazy taker if you've never met that person.
Michelle Nishan, stay where you are. We invite you to join the conversation on food policy in America. Is it where you think it should be? 203-776-9677, and we'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton. You can find what we talk about on the show online anytime right now, for instance, at WNPR.org. You can see right now delicious recipes for dinner, our value wines, easy cocktails, and much more. Just click on programs at WNPR.org for the Faith Middleton Show. Also, you will see details about our CPTV original documentary. It's called Give It All Away. And my guest, chef and author Michelle Nishan, who is co-founder of the Dressing Room Restaurant in Westport, Connecticut, co-founder with Paul Newman, is part of that documentary. And it is a look at how the Newman legacy through the Newman's Own Foundation has given so much to charities around the world, including Connecticut, and what the result is, the good that is being done on behalf of that money. It's quite amazing. So it includes a look at my guest Michelle Nishan's Wholesome Wave, doubling the value of food stamps if you buy fruits and vegetables at farmers markets for people who are on what we have called food stamps or SNAP. There's a look at Fidelco. These are guide dogs for returning vets, soldiers, the serious fun camps for children who are sick. And also, Jessica Posner, the student at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, who with Kennedy Odede has created a program, started a school for girls in Kenya's poorest neighborhood. What a documentary this is. And so the listing times are all up there on our site, WNPR.org. Michelle Nishan, let's come back to that bill on food stamps. There are cuts, and I don't know when they think they're going to pass this. There are cuts that are being asked at the same time that more people than ever are going into homeless shelters and food pantries. There's not room for them. And so many, many people are hungry in America. Mm. The largest numbers since the Great Depression. Mm. And there's a divide. We don't see this. This is hidden to those of us who are in the middle class or in upper classes. So what are these cuts going to look like? Is this going to affect breakfast programs for kids, school lunch programs?
It could. Right now it's looking much, much better because we had a bill that passed the Senate that was proposing $4 billion in cuts over a 10-year period that, with assurances from the Congressional Budget Office as well as the authors of the bill and on both sides of the party that actually passed and were advocates for this bill, that it was really going to be in streamlining the administrative processes. And a lot of it was basically the cost of the government involvement in distributing the program. Anything that is going to affect 50 million people and manage $80 billion is going to cost money to administer. So the assurances were that all of that was going to be in administrative cuts and that not one beneficiary would lose benefits. On the worst side of the house, the horrid, horrible House Nutrition Bill that passed that would cut $40 billion, almost 4 million Americans would have been pulled right off the rolls. And it's just unconscionable to think of that because, again, and some of the language around it in the House bill requires anybody of able body can only get food stamp, either can't get them or can get them for a very short period of time. And when we look at the million vets that are currently on food stamps, almost all of them are able-bodied, the majority of them. Yes, some of them are disabled, but plenty of them are able-bodied, but they're not able-minded. And they're dealing with PTSD. They're dealing with a lot of the backlash of trying to reassimilate into a non-war society. So many of these veterans, because we streamlined our military, went for multiple tours of duty in extremely violent conditions. And under those rules, I'm sorry. And it's funny, I don't often watch the Bill Maher show. I saw it and Casey Affleck was on because he has a movie coming out where mm-hmm. he plays a returning veteran. And he's done research on it. And there were two Republicans on the panel and he said, "This will pull the rug out from under veterans who are able-bodied but incapable of securing long-term employment." They had nothing to say because it's true. So, you know, it's the interesting thing to me is that there's just not enough outrage. Here we are, this nation that's supposed to be a beacon to the world. If you look at how highly we were valued after World War I and World War II, the country in favor of the underdog, not only don't kick somebody when they're down, but when they're down, put your hand out and pull them up, bring them up. This is neighborliness. That was the original premise. And somewhere through the Ayn Rand era of it's okay to be greedy and put number one first and take care of yourself first, then you can worry about everybody else, has become this obscene permission to ignore everybody else as long as you're taking care of yourself and your family. And it completely ignores the fact that for us to really have a wonderful place we can live in that we can all call home and be proud of, that everybody needs to be able to call it home and that your neighbors need to be secure and that your streets need to be clean and your schools need to be safe and that there are opportunities for everybody, not just for you and your family. So it's an interesting time that we're in right now.
Yeah. So Michelle Nishan, what's next for you at Wholesome Wave? If you look at this remarkable achievement with doubling food stamps for people on SNAP, fruits and vegetables at farmers markets. So you've put the farmers in touch with people in underserved communities, we'll say. Well, so what's next? Do you have a plan for your next project?
Well, we do. First, you know, the doubling program, it's operating in 28 states now. Mm-hmm. And language has survived all of these different iterations of the Farm Bill, actually providing public support for doubling food stamps at farm-to-retail venues, farm-direct venues, meaning farmers markets, CSAs, farm stands, et cetera. We love that, and we think that's fabulous. We also have a fruit and vegetable prescription program where we're working with doctors, nutritionists, and dietitians, community health workers, so that doctors can actually prescribe fruits and vegetables, and the prescription has a monetary value so that at-risk families that are pre-diabetic, obese, showing signs of heart disease, hypertension, can actually afford to eat the food that can help them prevent those diseases instead of waiting for them to get sick and then absolutely being able to give them free diabetes medicine. So it's kind of
how would that work? Yeah. A doctor can write a prescription for fruits and vegetables.
Yeah.
And who honors this?
Yeah. If I may, I'll describe how the current system works. If you're living in poverty, family of four, living on $12,000 a year, and you go to a free health clinic because you can't afford insurance and you have no employer to provide you insurance, and you're pre-diabetic, the doctor will say to you, you need to change your diet, eat more fruits and vegetables, eat less sugary stuff, or the next time I see you, you'll have diabetes. That's it. He can just say that, or she. They can just tell. And then the person goes home and they look at the $2 for the head of broccoli or the $2 for the – yeah, and they don't change because they can't afford to change their diet. But when they do get sick next year and they go back and they actually have diabetes, they now get free medicine for life because our society rightfully should not allow somebody to perish of a terminal illness or a chronic illness just because they're poor. So imagine what happens if you shift the money from waiting for someone to get sick and then paying for expensive medication to actually paying for the food and the lifestyle things that are way cheaper than the medicine up front so they never get sick in the first place.
So how do you intend to make something like this happen?
What we do is we pretend it exists by raising private money and enough money to engage all of these different stakeholders I mentioned so that they can behave this way. So we raise private money. We engage doctors and nurse practitioners at federally qualified community health centers and two public hospitals right now in Harlem, in the Bronx, in New York City, in several states. And the doctors extend the period of their visit to give more advice to the family. When they see a family member, a child, it starts with the index patient who is a child who is obese, pre-diabetic, indicating that they will contract some kind of diet-related or preventable health disease. They'll triage and find out that there are other family members, so the whole family member gets to participate. I have two children with diabetes, and we never once even considered having a separate cupboard for the two of our three children with diabetes and then have other food for the three. The whole family had to make the lifestyle change for my two sons to be successful with their long-term outcome. So it's the same approach. So the doctors spend more time, then send them to the dietitian who actually holds the prescription for the counseling, the coaching for healthy lifestyle, where to go and redeem these benefits, which is at a farmer's market, and then a community health worker escorts them. They do market tours. There are cooking classes. They become familiar with the market. They then use their prescription to buy the fruits and vegetables, and then monthly to have their prescription refilled, they have to go back and be measured for their health outcomes. Is their health improving as a result of being engaged in this program? And the answer 2 years in a row has been yes. Nearly 40% of index patients drop their BMI in a population that was where 100% were expected to either maintain or raise their BMI. And BMI is body mass index. If it's high, your chances of diabetes, heart disease are significantly higher than if your BMI is normal. So it's showing that treating food as prevention absolutely can help stop these diseases. And when we look at the cost to the American taxpayer, it drives me crazy because doctors, even the current administration, say obesity costs us $127 billion a year. Those are 2007 numbers, and that's just obesity. Diabetes costs $160 billion a year. Heart disease is over $140 billion a year. Diet-related forms of cancer are over $200 billion a year. Osteoporosis, hypertension. When you add it all together in that same 2007 Hain report from the Centers for Disease Control, it's $500 billion a year that the American taxpayer spends on these diet-related preventable diseases. So what better use of my taxpayer dollar than to put it into preventing those diseases with ingredients that are far cheaper than the ingredients that we need to treat those diseases once it's too late? So that's what the program's designed to address.
I worship you.
No, dude, you can't say that.
Michelle.
No, I'm not supposed to, but I'm saying. It's a whole bunch of us.
Michelle Nishan is chef and co-founder of The Dressing Room restaurant in Westport, Connecticut, a restaurant he co-founded with the late Paul Newman, and he's a cookbook author. He's founder of Wholesome Waves. It's based in Bridgeport, Connecticut, a nonprofit. He's discussing one of the new programs that they're getting into, making food more accessible to low-income populations, to people who have health issues. And Michelle Nishan is also a part of an original CPTV documentary talking about the profits from the Newman's Own Foundation and the organizations, Michelle's is one of them, that this money, these profits have gone into, Shining Hope for Communities, Fidelco, the Guide Dogs for Returning Soldiers, Serious Fund, the Camps for Very Sick Kids. It's quite a moving documentary, and that premieres on CPTV Tuesday, December 17th at 8 p.m. You can see all the airing times and find out more about Michelle Nishan and the Dressing Room Restaurant at our website, WNPR.org. Just search programs for the Faith Middleton Show, and that's posted there right now. In having a restaurant, Michelle, and being as concerned as you are about food policy and healthful eating, how truly now, how do you serve food? I mean, salt, fat, and sugar are what they are for a reason. They're in that food for a reason. They work.
Mm-hmm.
So
they're delicious.
They're wonderful. So
sure,
what do you, how do you get around this? How do you give people healthy food in a restaurant, have your food costs be affordable, and have that food be delicious? The kind of food that makes people say, oh, I want to have this again. I want to have, oh, that steak was delicious. Oh, I love that cornbread. Michelle knows I do love his cornbread. So how do you do it? What's the secret?
It's interesting because everybody's heard it a billion times. It's really about variety, diversity, and moderation. But I don't mean moderation, you know, specifically look towards eating less fat, eating less salt, eating less of those things. There are ways to get enough of those things in certain components of a meal where you feel completely satisfied when you mix them with other components of the meal where they might not exist, but those other components of the meal bring you fiber and phytonutrients and chemicals and the types of nutritive value that help mitigate things like saturated fat. Help.
Yeah, how are you going
really
to make it
bind
delicious?
To,
let's get to that part.
Well, a lot of it's just simple. Really honoring time honored practices like really good caramelization through a roasting process. Really, really making sure that you're reducing stocks and bringing them to that deeper level of flavor. And then you don't need to mount them with as much butter, or you don't need to add reduced cream. You really can look at concentrating flavors in ways that are very, very helpful for you. But the most important thing for me, one of the most important things is portion control. We have created this culture in the U.S. largely through marketing that bigger is better, supersize. I know so many people in America who, when they go out to dinner, if they can finish everything on their plate, they feel like they got ripped off. They want a steak the size of their torso. They want a baked potato the size of their head. And they don't care if they even put it in a doggy bag and take it home. If they were able to finish their meal, they got ripped off. And the real way we should be eating is like 4 ounces of animal protein. It's all we need. And animal protein is important for the B complex vitamins, et cetera. But it should be like that smaller amount of protein on the plate and caramelized Brussels sprouts with dried cranberries.
So how do you get away? I mean, how are you going to – we know what – I know what you're saying.
Listen, the roast has salt on it, right?
Yeah.
So it's got the crust. But it's a fourth the size of what everybody else serves. So you're getting a fourth of the salt. We're doing it, and people are fine with it. Another thing we do, like with our meatloaf, for instance, meatloaf, you got to think of meatloaf as a giant log-shaped meatball. And really great meatballs, it's like, how do we have my family get meat and get protein and feel like they're getting a lot of it, but how can we afford to do that? Because at one point, meat was the most expensive and vegetables are the cheapest. It's almost flipped now. But the way it was done is you add bread, you add eggs, you add milk, you add vegetables. So our meatloaf is almost 45% vegetables. We roast parsnips and turnips and carrots and onions and celery. And we make a panade with these really amazing whole grain breadcrumbs from Wave Hill Bread there in Wilton, Connecticut. They're fabulous.
Yeah.
With a little bit of milk, we make this panade with the breadcrumbs and a whole bunch of vegetables. And the meatloaf is so tender that when you pick it up with your fork, it feels like it's going to fall apart, but it doesn't. And then you put it in your mouth and you're like, oh my God, this is amazing. It's sweet. It's beautiful. This is the best meatloaf I ever have. No ketchup. Because the parsnip and the onions have been roasted and the sweetness is coming from natural vegetable sucrose. And when you're eating that meat, you're also getting all of those vegetables and then the vegetables that the meatloaf is served on. So it's really about reducing. I mean, we could have almost a 85% meat meatloaf where most of it's meat and very little of it's filler. And put that side by side with ours, people are going to enjoy ours better because it's softer and it's lusher and it's more interesting in flavor. It's just as satisfying. And they're getting a lot less of the stuff, the saturated fat and things that cause your liver to produce more cholesterol. So it's really taking a look at the overall plate as a recipe and how much of the stuff that could be bad for us in large amounts but isn't in smaller amounts, and how do we engineer that in a way where people feel completely satisfied when they've finished. That's the approach we take. It's a strategy.
Michelle Nishan is chef and co-founder of The Dressing Room Restaurant in Westport, Connecticut, and he returns with us. We'd love to hear from you at 203-776-9677. What needs to happen in the food world for you? 203-776-WNPR. Don't go away. You can tweet us at FaithWNPR, that's FAITHWNPR, or join the conversation with us on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks to you for listening and to our talented team, senior producer Lori Mack and producer Jonathan McNichol. Chef and cookbook author Michelle Nishan is here. He is co-founder with the late Paul Newman of The Dressing Room Restaurant in Westport, Connecticut. And we are talking about food policy, food stamps, the SNAP program, what's going on with food policy in America. So, Michelle, do you think that the craze for local eating, has it gone loco? Here's what I mean. I mean, it has gotten to the point now where people are saying that you must eat what is growing now. You must eat in season. You can't eat past 100 miles from where you live. If something has been flown in from anywhere, that's not a good idea. We're setting a bad example. You know, in this modern age, does this make any sense?
Sure, if you live in California. Or if you live in climates and regions that support a 12-month growing season or areas that have soil that will support the type of crop and animal diversity that you need to have the full range of a healthy diet. And there simply are places in our country that cannot be done. There are some innovations with greenhousing, the work that Elliot Coleman has done up in Maine, being able to grow 12 months a year. In a pretty hostile growing environment, completely off the grid, but that's not something that's readily available for everybody and anybody. I'm happy with the craze because what local means to me is when you can absolutely, with great vigor, support producers in your area that are growing food, raising animals, and buy from them and really support their businesses. You're keeping your money in your local economy, and those dollars are recirculating, and that's the type of activity that used to make Main Street America possible. It was we were a nation of many, many farms, millions of farmers. When the Green Revolution happened, the business plan was to repurpose 20 million American farmers to the new industrial age because we really only needed maybe 1 million or 2 million farmers to actually run these bigger, more quote-unquote efficient conventional farms. When there were the 20 million farmers and the smaller scale farmers, you had diverse equipment. That equipment had to be built, manufactured, repaired, maintained, boots, straps, tack, you name it. You know, the agricultural economy, when it really reflects the diet we all should be eating, a wide variety of diverse seasonal products, some of which need to be shipped to other areas of the country that can't grow their own stuff. I mean, if you look at North Dakota, it's a great place for cattle. It's a lousy place for fruits and vegetables. So the cattle, and if you try to, you know, do local cattle on Long Island to take care of the beef needs of Long Island, you'd have to move 2/3 of the population off to make room for enough cows to take care of the 1/3 of the remaining population. It's just not possible. There's built environment, et cetera. But we can and should be doing way more than we're doing now. And I think our Department of Agriculture and our Congress and our political leaders are irresponsible if they don't acknowledge that and if they don't acknowledge the role that these local businesses play in the health of our nation. When we're at our absolute best with the least amount of people living and struggling with poverty in America, it was when we had millions of vibrant, diverse farming operations, some quite large and many extremely small, as well as a strong community gardening movement and a lot of Americans who knew how to grow a food plant and what to do with the food at the other end of it. I think in 1943, Franklin Roosevelt gave a speech back when the USDA used to do consumption censuses, and he pointed out that in 1942, 48% of fresh food consumed by all Americans came from privately held victory gardens because the larger farms had to feed the Allied army. So the governors, the Conference of Governors, and Eleanor Roosevelt encouraged everybody to do victory gardens. People were growing their own food. So anybody who thinks the community gardening movement is boutique is a wackadoo, because we did it once. We were at half of our population then.
And doesn't this speak to the importance of gardening programs in schools?
Absolutely.
We see, you know, big push from First Lady Michelle Obama about this. We see lots and lots of schools taking this up, having gardens. And I'm not just talking about inner city schools. I'm talking about schools all over. We see these kids having gardens, coming home with the plants, talking about what they're growing. We see some magnet schools specializing in being farm schools. And these students coming in who have no idea where anything has come from. And they learn through those school programs.
Well, they do. You know, and it's interesting, Faith, because when you take a child, especially in the early phases, they catch on quick. They catch on way quicker than I do. I'm constantly handing my smartphone and my computer off to children to help me figure out how to navigate through. They just get it quick. And when you expose them to growing at an early age, whether they've ever seen a pea or a zucchini or an eggplant, when they plant the seed, they see the miracle of that growth. They're astonished by it. They're enthused by it. They take responsibility for the life of that plant. And when the fruit is there, they eat it because they grew it. They have a direct vested interest in that plant. It's part of themselves. They're proud of it. That gets them to try eggplant faster than trying to convince them that eggplant is something they should be eating. If they've never seen it before, they didn't encounter it and didn't have that direct relationship. So it's a very, very powerful way to set the tone for our future generations to make healthier food choices.
What's the role of young people cooking? You know, parents are so busy now, working, if they're lucky enough to have jobs, just trying so hard to get everything accomplished. There's more homework than ever. Kids are in all these after-school programs. It is a madhouse. And so the idea of families cooking together sounds pretty sweet and beneficial. But getting it done, I think it's pretty hard.
Yes, no. Yes, when we think about it, no, if we actually look at models that once worked. So my mom's family, she was one of 13 children in a classic American farm where the families were large so that you could manage the farm, so that you could bring enough crop to bear, so that you had a market that could pay your land costs, pay your carrying costs, get you the things that you couldn't grow, like a tractor, or a truck to get your food to and from market, or, you know, school books, things like that. When my mom and all my aunts and uncles were being raised on that farm, they all worked 12 and 14 hours a day. They went to school. They were no less busy than anybody else was. But the fact that the entire family could cook, I mean, all my aunts, all my uncles were expert cooks, and they thought you were weird if you didn't cook. Today we ask people when we meet somebody new, we say, "So what do you do?" Yeah, my relatives would say, "So what do you cook?" And if you said nothing, they would look at you with shock in their face and scratch their head and say, why are you still alive? How do you live, right? So when you get the whole family participating in the process, it's like in a kitchen. No one person can serve 200 people on a Friday night. But you get eight people together, you can serve 200 people on a Friday night. You get four family members directly engaged in food, and you have a little bit of a food plan together of what are the things where you can cook enough for all 5 or 6 days of the week ahead of time and draw off of it during the course of the week. And you get everybody involved in that. You can cook a hell of a lot more food than feeling like it should be the job of one person in the family to cook for everybody.
Leanse Faith Middleton with Michelle Nishan. Go ahead, Leanse.
Hi, how are you guys doing? Okay,
great. Thanks. Go ahead.
I got a quick question for you, and I apologize. I turned in late. I happened to catch a post that Fun Live put on Facebook and stating that you guys were going to be on the show. So I just tuned in. So forgive me if I addressed something that you guys might have covered already. But I did have a question for you guys about the SNAP program and nutrition. You have Michael Bloomberg, who is trying to limit the size of sodas and tax, soda based upon how big, large the soda was. And you have Michelle Obama trying to dictate what these kids are eating at school, yet people could take a SNAP card, a food stamp card, and go in and buy energy drinks. They can buy soda. They can buy candy. They can buy ice cream. They can buy all these items, and there's no government regulation. And I think it's due in part because they don't want to upset their voter base. And I was wondering what you guys think about the SNAP program, and do you agree with me in that there should be limitations on the types of products that people could buy with those?
Lance, that's a great question, and it's a great point. I have a lot of experience in this because I've been working in that field now for over 6 years. And first, I do want to say that for the majority of these families, energy drinks and sugared sodas, they're buying them. There actually were a couple of studies done recently that show that SNAP families don't buy any more soda per family member or consume any more soda per family member than folks that aren't on the benefits. So it kind of tracks about the same. The difficulty with most of these folks that are relying on the benefits is that they the only thing they can afford to buy are highly processed food. So very common meal for a family of four in the communities that we serve is instant rice with a can of condensed soup and then some kind of snack before the kids go to bed before they don't cry hungry, so they don't cry hungry. There's one area we work in Chicago where within 60 square blocks, the only place you can buy food at all is at a gas station or a liquor store. And Hamburger Helper is in these liquor stores, but they sell no meat. So you either stir condensed milk or condensed soup into the Hamburger Helper, and it's just not a healthy meal. And if you eat like that, you will get obese, but you'll still be hungry. So what's happening right now is Food and Nutrition Services, Kevin Concannon, who is the Undersecretary of Food and Nutrition Services, they run the food stamp program, is looking at requiring grocers to carry a certain depth of stock to be able to accept food stamps at all, which would put pressure on these liquor stores, on these gas stations, on these corner stores to carry fruits, vegetables, and healthier foods. Because I'll tell you where we work, Lance, when we make fruits and vegetables available and affordable to people on food stamps, they shift the way they spend their food stamps. They buy a lot more fruits and vegetables. They consume more, and they're losing weight. So, you know, it is an affordability issue. And I think until we get to that paradigm where somebody who can't afford a car can't afford a bus transfer, can get to where healthy food is, it's tough to restrict what they're eating.
Thank you for the call, and thank you, Michelle Nishan, who is co-founder with the late Paul Newman of The Dressing Room in Westport, Connecticut, and he is one of the people profiled, his nonprofit organization called Wholesome Wave, doubling the amount of food stamps, the value of them for fruits and vegetables in low-income communities. That and many other organizations, all beneficiaries of the Newman Foundation's charity work, really. Just really quite extraordinary. Very moving documentary. And it premieres Tuesday, December 17th, 8 p.m. at many repeat dates. And so you can go to our website right now, WNPR.org. Click on Programs for the Faith Middleton Show to find out more about Michelle Nishan and the documentary, Giving It All Away. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank
See you soon. As always, this show is about the richness of life. You can find the books, people, great recipes, value wines, and cocktails we feature right now at WNPR.org. Click on Programs. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.